Hi, welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, on Twitter at Literary Italy. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button. And if you like our podcast, consider giving us a good review at Apple Podcasts, at Google Podcasts, at Stitcher, or whatever, wherever you get your podcast. Anne is...
I want to say
she's indisposed, but...
Because the worst thing... You know how, like, the worst thing to say to someone who's crying is, stop crying?
Yes.
The worst thing to say to someone who's laughing is, now stop laughing.
Right. This is... every episode that we do is very much like the Chuckles the Clown episode of... So Anne will probably by the end, since we started laughing, probably by the end of this episode be crying.
I'm already crying.
Hi, welcome Anne.
Welcome Jim. And doing? Welcome to our listeners.
Hi listeners.
We appreciate you listening.
Cari ascoltatori. That's the only thing I can say.
We have really
Italian.
Great listeners.
Yeah, we do.
They listen really, really well.
With both ears. They're not just like left, right ear listeners, which would be like left brain, right ear listeners.
Yeah.
You listen with both ears. You listen to our hearts.
Yeah, they they listen to their hearts, and it tells them what to do.
Yeah, we couldn't get the rights to that Tom Petty song.
So today, what we've been doing is usually three episodes about a literary work.
Oh, you can't reveal the magic to them. You can't reveal our secret sauce. No, I have to. This is a company secret. Berrettini podcast. You stop right there. According to a scientific formula, this is going to be a very scientific formula. This is going to be a day when we don't talk about a specific work. Although, there's certainly a literary overlay.
Yeah, we can definitely talk
about that. So we're going to talk about a pilgrimage that Anne took in 2019 and that I am going to be taking this fall called the Via Francigena. And I kind of wanted to start off by asking you, Anne, what a pilgrimage walk is.
That's what got me laughing. Because I do think a pilgrimage walk...
A pilgrimage. What's a pilgrimage?
Oh, right. Pilgrimage is a journey to a destination that usually has some sort of a spiritual relevance.
Mm-hmm.
Although you could have a pilgrimage to Hollywood or something,
right?
You know, to see the graves of famous actors. But it usually has... the destination is... is important.
And there's also a sense that we're passing through as strangers, right? So, well, because I don't know, whenever someone asks me what a pilgrimage is, who do you go to? Van Morrison. Nothing but a stranger in this world. And one of the things that the pilgrimage reminds the spiritually attuned person is that we're sojourning, we're traveling.
Right. I think a better question would have been, what is a pilgrim?
I think you just asked that question. I don't know why you want to do this one-upsmanship with me. I mean, you just asked the question. You can answer it.
That
you
the
have
pilgrim-
this cr- kind of cr- Oh, boy.
We're not going to get past this
Yeah,
one
we're
question.
Not going to. Well, what's a pilgrim? Okay, what's a pilgrim? So that's a great question.
All right,
it's my question.
Pilgrim is the one who is journeying. I mean.
Pilgrim is the one who's on the pilgrimage.
Who's making the pilgrimage. But if you look at some of the, there was kind of this movement toward pilgrimage about 1,000 years ago.
Right.
And one of the things that a lot of the works about pilgrimage emphasize is this idea that we are all pilgrims in this life.
Nothing but a stranger in this world.
So that, and so this would be for the Christian, the destination is heaven.
Dear listener, I advise you to break out your copy of Astral Weeks right now and just put it on. Grab yourself a beer or something to mill you.
That's okay, but that's not what I was thinking of at all.
Of course.
But this idea that we are all sort of, we're not here forever, you know, and that we are in this world as that this life is a kind that if we see this life as a kind of journey, I guess the question has to be, what is the destination? Is it simply death? Is there something beyond death?
Anne Shookman, you are so deep. How about just something really simple? Can we do that?
I did that from the very beginning.
Okay.
I said a pilgrimage walk is a walk to a particular destination.
And what are some of the destinations that people go? So one is Santiago.
Right. The most famous pilgrimage walk, at least for Americans, is the Camino de Santiago, mostly in Spain, a little bit in France.
Uh-huh. And so Santiago, Rome is a common destination.
Right. Rome is a destination.
Jerusalem is probably the mother of all of them. It started this thing called the Crusades a few years,
Mecca.
Back. Mecca is a,
you know, and then there are also a number of walks. I mean, you might say that the Appalachian Trail is a kind of, is it a pilgrimage? I mean,
that's a good question.
There is a pilgrimage, out west of the mission churches, you know, that there is in California. Uh-huh. And I think that is perhaps seen more as a pilgrimage than something like
the Appalachian Trail. I think the difficulty with the Appalachian Trail, it's hard to see what the destination is. There's a terminus, but, and that might make it more of a pilgrimage in as much as it really is about, so it's more purely about sojourning. You're always in transit on the...
To talk about the Via Francigena, I was talking about ostensibly the destination is Rome, but there are plenty of people who just go out, especially if they live in Italy and they can get out there for a long weekend, mm-hmm. who might go out and just walk 2-3 days, walk a long weekend, and walk maybe 50 miles, maybe 40 miles or over a weekend. And they, you know, so the question is, are they not walking a pilgrimage? Are they not doing a pilgrimage? I only did the last 200 right. miles of this about 1,100 mile route. Did I not do the pilgrimage? If I had stopped before Rome, did I not do the, you
so
know?
Let's talk about the full path.
Let's talk about what it is.
Yeah, let's talk about what it is. So where does it start, the full pilgrimage, and where does it end? Because it sounds like you can get on virtually anywhere, but where, if you do the full walk, where do you start and where do you stop?
So the Via Francigena begins in Canterbury, England. The reason Canterbury is that what is now this modern Via Francigena is based on the writing of the Archbishop of Canterbury of 990. Sigerico is serio. Cedric the Serious.
Right. He was British, right?
Yes. So we can
call him and we can give him an English name.
Well, I say Cedric. So he was Sigerico. I mean, he was named Archbishop of Canterbury, and he walked to Rome to receive his pallium. Mm. You know, this from the Pope.
What's the pallium?
It marks him as the bishop, archbishop. Okay. It's a vestment that the Pope would bestow upon the archbishop.
Okay.
So Sigerico went to Rome. He apparently walked to Rome. It's a little bit unclear what his route was going south, and it seems like he only stayed for like 3 days, which seems really strange to walk all that way. But then he turned around and walked back up to Canterbury. And the reason that's important is because he took notes. And so he talked about, you know, very, very briefly, stayed at this monastery. We walked about this many hours, and then we got to this town. And so that kind of provided a sort of route. Because truthfully, I mean, the ancient Rome, and this predates Christianity, because this is based on the ancient Roman road of the Via Cassia. And so these ancient Roman roads they were used, and they got bigger and they got bigger. And then as cars came in, they became highways. So many of these ancient roads are now, they're not walkable. You know, there are parts of the Via Francigena where you're walking along the Via Cassia, which is a highway, and it's not pleasant at all. You know, there are some alternate routes to try to get off of it. But as much as possible, they've tried to make this into a walking path so that you're not walking on asphalt for most of it, that you're walking on maybe gravel roads, wooded paths, small, you know, there dirt trails through the woods, that kind of thing.
How did you decide to walk the Via Francigena?
You know, it's probably about 5 or 6 years ago. I was thinking about walking the Camino de Santiago. Mm-hmm. You know, at least it was in my head to do something right. like that. I think the Appalachian Trail is beyond me because I do not want to camp overnight. and I, you know, the Camino de Santiago is very well set up. It's been for several decades. People have been walking it. And so they have these, you know, places that you can stay. It's relatively inexpensive, you know, maybe €15 a night for dinner and a bed. But when I found out about 5 or 6 years ago that there was this trail in Italy, I thought, oh, well, Italy, you know, and I thought, well, first of all, I have a better command of Italian than I do of Spanish. I've always wanted to see more of the Italian countryside, but not necessarily driving, because when you're driving, obviously you have to pay attention to the road. It's a little bit of a different feeling. And I love hiking. Yeah, I really love hiking. So I kind of became a little bit obsessed. You can tell me if you think that was true or not, but I really became kind of obsessed, and I began finding out everything I could about this route. And, you know, I knew in order to walk the entire thing, like from Canterbury to Rome, you really have to allow about 3 months. And I knew I couldn't do that. You know, and at one point I was actually thinking of taking the kids, maybe we do a family thing. And it was just very apparent that no one else was interested. So I thought, you know, I'm going to do this on my own. And it was the year that I turned 50. So that seemed like a good time. I got a plane ticket for like, I don't know, it was under $350 round trip, which seemed like a sign. And so I decided to walk about 2 weeks. The last, you know, I was in Italy for 14 days. So I have that little buffer of the day I land and, right, the, you know, a day or two before I leave. And so I walked about 300 kilometers.
That's a long walk.
It was a long walk. You know, so my days, my mileage per day varied from maybe eight, nine miles the first day. I wanted to take it easy, to days where I was doing 20, 21, 22 miles. A lot depends, because, I mean, you might say, well, today I'm only going to do 6 miles, but if you finish 6 miles and there's no town there, you have to keep walking. I mean, there are some people that camp. Technically, free camping in Italy, that would be camping not in a designated campground, is illegal. I have heard that people will turn a blind eye to it as long as you're sort of out of the way and discreet, but that's not something I'm interested in doing. As I said, that's part of the reason the Appalachian Trail is not appealing to me.
So I'm starting it, following in your footsteps, I'm starting it in the fall. What should I bring? How should I prepare? We've talked a little bit about this on our own. We went shopping. I got a backpack. That's kind of the first thing that I've done. But what else? Yep. What else do I need to get? What should I think about?
So the three most important items. Number one is number one are your shoes.
Okay.
So there's something to talk about. Now, the Via Francigena, especially the part that we're going to be talking about today in Tuscany and Lazio. Lazio is the region that Rome is in. Is rolling hills. There are certainly some climbs, in the sense that you're going uphill quite a bit, because these are mostly, you know, you finish in a hilltop town. So at the end of every day, you have this nice incline that you have to get up. But it's not like climbing. You're not climbing hand over foot like if you were mountain climbing. So I would say, at least for that part of the Via Francigena, you really don't need hiking boots. And I use trail runners.
So trail runners or hiking boots sound like kind of what you would do.
I would say not hiking boots, because hiking boots are heavy.
But people are doing it in hiking boots. Other people you've seen there.
You know, if you're a hiker and you're really habituated to certain shoes, then wear them.
Right.
But I guess the most important thing is that whatever you do wear for footwear, and you know, some people will do Teva sandals or something like that. Some people who are accustomed to walking many miles in those kinds of shoes, they can do it. You know, I think the more important thing is that it's something that you're accustomed to wearing, and that's something that you have some practice ahead of time wearing.
Okay.
You know, that you maybe take several weekends that you do on each week and do a 10 to 12 mile hike.
So number one was walking shoes.
All right. So yeah, number one, walking shoes. But then the backpack. I mean, I think that's
number two
kind of,
is the backpack.
And considering that, as I said, you're not camping in most cases. Mm-hmm. So you don't need the tent. You don't need the cooking stuff. In fact, you're going to be passing through town so you can pick up food.
So the backpacks they're measured off by volume usually, right? By like liters,
right,
basically.
So I think for most people, you can probably get by with a 30 to 40 liter backpack, which is fairly small. I mean, it might be described as like a weekender backpack for a backpacker.
And that would be as opposed to like more of like a 50 or 60, which would be if you're walking the Appalachian Trail and camping at night and need to bring your tent with you and all your sleeping stuff, your sleeping bag and tent.
Yeah.
You would be doing that, right?
Yeah.
Got it.
But the neat thing about the Via Francigena is, because this is an ancient road, and just because, I mean, Italy is ancient, Europe is ancient, that you are, every maybe 10 miles or so, you're passing through a small town. And that these are small, old towns. So in many cases, some of the lodging is in places like monasteries that no longer are active, but they still have the accommodations. I mean, they still have the rooms. So these monasteries, in some cases, can put pilgrims up. In other cases, you may find something like a bed and breakfast, or an, you know, Airbnb is a little bit trickier because a lot of times those are expensive for one night. You know, usually you're better off if you're staying three nights or more.
So if you had to break it down for what your experience when you started just north of Siena, you walked about 200 miles. But how much of that would you estimate was staying in a hostel as opposed to like a monastery or convent or converted monastery? Or
well,
convent.
The hostels are, for in most cases, converted monasteries and
convents. Maybe the thing I'm looking for is how often will I be in a room with 20 other people as opposed to?
You know, most of the hostels are small, so you may have a room. I mean, I don't think I was ever in a room with more than 12, but, you know, we are talking bunks and they're co-ed. And in some cases, even the bathrooms were co-ed. I mean, so that was a bit of an eye-opener.
So to speak.
You know, but I would say, so anyway, I would say I was about half and half.
Okay. I think I interrupted you because I think we said the three things. What was the third thing that I need
socks.
To bring? I need socks.
No, but it's very important. Good socks. I have issues with my feet where, you know, just the whole, that's, we could do a whole podcast on my feet.
No, because I don't want to, I do love our listeners, but I don't want to see the listeners I get if we start doing
a
foot podcast.
It's true. So I wear socks that are called toe socks and they're goofy looking and they're like gloves for your feet. But so the sock actually fits around each toe individually. It helps to prevent blisters. And for just the way my feet are, it helps me to not have nerve pain in my feet, which is something that I was having. I was also having plantar fasciitis before I started walking. And so I needed to get to have good footwear. You know, we can talk a little bit more about the kinds of clothes you want to bring, but you know, we're talking, when I say 30 liter backpack, that is a small backpack. So basically you want the clothes that you have on, a change of clothes, and maybe an extra pair of socks, extra underwear. And I brought I was walking in May. And so I brought a dress. This was like my downtime clothes that I just slept in. You know, I didn't bring pajamas. I just slept in that dress. And then the next morning put on my clothes for hiking.
So if you're used to running, that's sort of like spandex, lycra, synthetics.
Yes, actually, that's a good point. So any clothes that you bring, you should probably try them out ahead of time, not only on these long walks, but you should also try them out as far as washing and hanging them overnight and seeing how they dry. So cotton is awful. Cotton kills, as they say in hiking. You know, cotton is bad because it absorbs your sweat and holds it there. So
so something that wicks.
Synthetic wicks materials. Yeah, that's really what you want.
Okay.
So what were we talking about?
Well, I think our the question was, I'm going to be completely greedy and steer this podcast toward me because I have to figure out how I'm going to do this in October. And I guess our first question, the first question before I booked it for October should have been, is October a good time to go? What's a good time to go? You went in May. What, do you have any suggestions?
You know,
and really, maybe there's different suggestions depending on how much, because we could talk a little bit about, even though you didn't walk it, about the Swiss and pre-Swiss part of it, and because that would greatly constrain when you could do it.
Right.
But when should you, what can I think about in terms of times of year to go?
Well, we're talking about Tuscany and Lazio. Really, you could go any time of the year. Just be aware that things are going to be different. So you're going to have more rain in March and April, typically. But I walked during a very rainy May. It was quite muddy parts of it. I brought a lightweight jacket and a fleece sweater that I thought, like a fleece sweatshirt. And I thought, like, whatever I brought, I was prepared to leave, to donate or something. But I didn't get rid of any of the clothes because it was cold and it was quite cool, especially at night, you know. And so layers, as always, definitely want to wear layers.
And particularly if you're in.
Yeah. So cooler. October, you know, October is usually a wonderful month to visit Italy. It's not quite as crowded, you know, even as September. And the weather is usually pretty good. Warms up during the day, cool at night. Most of these hostels, just to be aware, they will not have any heat on until November. So if it's really cool in October, you could be pretty cold.
Right.
And I should mention that, so in addition to your change of clothes and things like that, you would want to bring a kind of towel. So I have a microfiber towel, so it weighs hardly anything at all, and it dries very quickly. And also a sleep sack for the hostels. So you don't actually need a sleeping bag, but a sleep sack is basically a sleeping bag made out of a sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, for your own hygiene, but also for the hygiene of the hostel around you, you would have that sleep sack.
And that could provide a little bit of warmth on those.
Very little. You can get them made out of silk, which is actually a pretty
surprisingly warm. Yeah, and October is usually not terribly, terribly cold.
Yeah, but you know.
You never know.
Yeah, no.
And to go back to what I alluded to earlier, if you are starting earlier, and if you're starting before, to remind listeners, the full pilgrimage trail, which very few people walk, it's fairly long, or not a lot of people walk. A lot of people walk parts of it. But the full trail starts in Canterbury, England. It crosses the channel, so you would take some conveyance across, say, a ferry across the English Channel. It walks through France, through Switzerland, and then through Italy. So in Switzerland, it goes through the Great St. Bernard Pass. And that Great St. Bernard Pass, and that is not, as I understand it, that's not passable through the entire year.
The road is closed pretty much from, I think it's around September until May. However, the trail could still be passable. Yes, the trail can be passable when the road is not. But it's sort of like you kind of have to find out as you get there what it's like. And it's not something you want to mess with, that if just because the weather can change very quickly up there.
Right. But you might find yourself saying, oh, well, I'm going to do transport around this part of the, if you're doing anything north of the Great St. Bernard Pass, you may wind up having to take some transportation to get through that, depending on the time of year you're doing it.
Right. And I would say that if you're someone that really likes a heavy duty, like you want a heavy duty hard hike, I would actually encourage you to go up to northern Italy to hike. I mean,
yeah, you're in the Alps at that point.
I mean, that's like climb every mountain.
So, or at least climb some of the Alpine ones.
We're talking also what you should bring. One thing to be, you know, and also about when you're walking. If you're walking in July and August, heat is definitely a factor. So, you need to make sure that you're bringing along enough water. So in some cases along the way, there are towns where you can stop and get water. There are occasional water sources, like little fountains along the way, but I carried at least 2 liters of water with me on days that were a couple of days that where it was, I knew it was going to be a long walk. And I knew from my guidebook that there might not be any sources for water. I carried a full 3 liters. And so every liter of water is a kilo. It's 2.2 pounds. That in itself, I mean, 3 liters right there is over six pounds. So that's quite a bit of weight. But in general, you want to try to keep your pack as light as possible. But it isn't the same thing as like a heavy duty backpack with carrying everything, because the great thing about the Via Francigena going through Italy is that it's going through Italy. So you have amazing food. And once you get to your destination, at least for the day, you know, most places you can take a shower, get changed, and you can go maybe walk around the little town and get something to eat. And, you know, you're walking. What's really amazing is that you're walking through these vineyards and then in the evening having a glass of wine from those same vineyards.
So to prepare, you consulted a couple of guidebooks. There's the Cicerone guidebook, and there's, what's that other?
This is the Terre di Mezzo, which is an Italian publisher, but it's translated into English, also into French and German, I think. The Via Francigena, 1,000 kilometers on foot from the Gran San Bernardo to Rome. And that is the Cicerone from 2021, right?
Right. Yes, it is. So those are kind of a couple of publishers. If you're considering doing it, looking, I think the website. There is a website.
Yes. And there's a website and there's also an app. There's an app for that. And so the great thing is that.
But it was what I was going to say is that the on the website, they're now promoting quasi-officially the chicharrone, right? This is kind of what they're pointing people to, at least in English these days.
That's because that's the chicharrone people.
Okay.
So, you know, that's a very complicated thing. Like, who is actually in charge of this Via Francigena?
Right. Not saying
and
that
that's
right.
beyond this.
That's why I said quasi-official.
Yeah. Right. I will say, you know, with only the experience of Tuscany and Lazio, the trail is very well marked. I occasionally would begin to doubt, like I'd be walking and I'd think, oh, I haven't seen a blaze in a while. And right at that moment, I would see a blaze. So you become very used to seeing this red and white spot, you know, that's on trees, sometimes on asphalt or maybe on a stake in the ground. And it's fairly easy to follow. But in addition, there's also an app that if you have, you know, with your GPS on your phone, can actually indicate where you are in regards to the trail. So once or twice it did happen to me. There was one time there was one sign that was torn down and I ended up walking off the trail maybe about 100 yards. And I kind of had a feeling I wasn't going in the right direction because I was heading toward a field with sheep and those sheep dogs, the Maramani, these are these really big white.
They're very protective.
They're very protective of their sheep. And I just thought, this doesn't seem right that I should be walking through a field of sheep. So I looked at my app and I saw, sure enough, there I was, the little dot, and I was off the trail. And
you also said something about a wolf dog? Am I
well,
the,
yes,
up?
But that was in some guy's yard.
Well, I want to make sure I don't hit the wolf dog this time around.
Well, he wasn't.
Oh, he was fine?
He was a pet, right.
Oh, okay.
You know,
what about the dog that bit your foot?
So that brings us to another, but that does
and
bring
should
us
should I take polls that
to
I can hit
question.
Dogs that might bite
you know,
my foot?
I was asked quite a bit before I went, if I was scared and if it was safe. That was like a number one. And I think partly that's being a woman walking alone.
And here I thought you were just making obscure references to Marathon Man every time you kept saying,
Is it safe? I mean, I don't think you didn't seem particularly concerned about me. I must say.
I know how tough you are.
But
I know the strength of a good woman.
You know, I will say I felt safe. I felt safe the whole time. You know, there was probably one time, you know, coming into Rome, you walk through a park in Rome that's sort of on the outskirts and it's a little bit, it just felt a little seedy. And I felt the least comfortable there, but I am comfortable in the woods and I am comfortable in the countryside. And another thing I'll say, I mean, a big difference between the Via Francigena and the Camino de Santiago is scale. I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of people walking the Camino de Santiago every year, like 500,000, I think is. I think it's something like 350,000 people arrived in Santiago in 2019. 2020 isn't, we're going to just forget that ever happened. But in 2019, that's 350,000 who actually just made it to Santiago. So other people, you know, maybe they just, as I said, they just do 3 or 4 days or a week someplace, you know.
Or died in a mudslide.
No. So in the
what happened in the Martin Sheen movie?
I thought it was Exposure.
Yeah, it was something like that.
But
like
actually, I mean, to mention, so there's this Martin Sheen movie from about
the mid-2020s.
Yeah. Oh, you think it's, okay.
Not to 2020. Oh, you think it's 20 years old.
Okay, we'll have to look
it up. I
want
to say about 2010. It's about 10 years old.
All right. Yeah, maybe about that. And it's kind of a quiet, but it's a nice movie. I mean, and it's about the a man walking, the Martin Sheen, walking the Camino de Santiago. And I don't know if it was that movie or what, but that trail has become immensely popular, particularly among Americans. So if you want to be surrounded by Americans, as particularly like in the summer, college-age Americans, I mean, maybe that's the right place to go for you. Wait, let me finish.
Please.
The Via Francigena, if you want solitude, that is probably a better walk for you. And yep. And honestly, as a mom of four, you're surrounded by kids, the house, other responsibilities. It was just the perfect gift for myself for my 50th birthday.
Right.
Was to have 2 weeks and to kind of like pass by a restaurant and say, that looks good. I think I'll go in. And maybe I went in and would say, well, that restaurant actually wasn't that good, but it was okay. You know, because it was just me.
The only thing I was going to add was just that the Camino yes, you'll encounter more Americans, but you'll just encounter more people, period. There's just a larger volume, and that's clear if you do any of the research.
That said, it is also the infrastructure is much, much better developed. Now, the best developed infrastructure on the Via Francigena is the Tuscany Lazio section. Mm. So you get to France and people do camp because there's no other place to stay. And you get to maybe Switzerland and you have to pay 100, 150 euro a night for a hotel because there's no other place to sleep.
And this you got from people who, so you joined people who had already walked the part of the French route.
Yes. And this is just based on, you know, reading blogs and things like that.
Yeah.
But in Tuscany and Lazio, as I said, there are a number of these hostels. Not every town has one, but if you can't find that, you can usually find like a pensione or a bed and breakfast and a place where you can, you know, have a room and a bathroom, something like that. What gets a little bit more challenging is washing your clothes. So what I would typically do is once I got to the place I was staying that night, I would take a shower and wash my clothes of the day and hang them out and really hope that they would dry. I think on my birthday, I treated myself to an inn and that cost like 45 euro for the night. I averaged about $50 a day. That was for room and board. So if you're thinking about, you know, you want to do sort of an expensive trip to Italy, maybe the Via Francigena is for you because it can be done very cheaply. But on the other hand, you're not seeing, you know, where things start getting expensive is when you start getting into the bigger city centers. So it goes through these tiny small towns and it goes through, like if you see, you know, Google Tuscany countryside and you see these gorgeous pictures and you think, how do I get there? You know, yes, you can rent a car and you can drive around. But in walking a route like the Via Francigena, you're walking through all of this. And from a cultural point of view, you're walking through history. You know, there's no, you're part of, you know, you are like, there's one part where I was walking along old Roman roads, you know, and they still have the grooves from the old tracks of the wheels. You know, that's amazing. I mean, you're walking, you are part of, these are the same routes, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had the podcast on Catherine of Siena and we talked about how she went to Florence and she went up to Avignon. These are the same routes, at least parts of them, that these people, then Dante, you know, that they were walking. This is the way they went. And in general, I mean, for people did sort of travel, congregate on these roads because it was safer. Because, you know, as I said, I didn't feel unsafe, but there aren't a whole lot of brigands, you know, bandits in rural Italy as there were 1,000 years ago. And, oh, you were, yeah, when you should go, you know, there are pros and cons to various times of the year. You know, if you want to see sunflowers, I guess September. You know, if you want to see poppies, you know, you're talking more like April and May, I guess. But it really depends on the time of the year.
So what was the most unexpected thing during your travels? What surprised you the most about doing the walk, or did nothing? I don't know. Was it boring? Was it? Give a little bit of the.
You know,
flavor.
I think that. So a couple of things. I mean, one is having spent quite a bit of time in Italy. I was just, you know, and I have spent a lot of time in the countryside as well, but I was really struck by the beauty of the countryside and the nature. So a couple of things. I saw deer, which I had never seen deer, and their deer, their capriolo, is this tiny. It looks like a deer that went through the dryer, like a white-tailed deer that is shrunk down. Very cute. I saw pheasants, ringneck pheasants, which I don't think are indigenous, but we used to have them growing up on Long Island. I haven't seen them or heard them in decades, and there they were. You know, I found porcupine quills. I didn't see the porcupines. I actually saw their footprints, and I couldn't figure out what it was because I thought it looked like a raccoon footprints, but they don't have raccoons there. So I asked someone, and they were like, oh, yeah, that's a porcupine. But what I think that you become as you walk, so I walked, as I said, you know, I average probably about 18 miles a day. As you walk, you become very open emotionally. I think also open-minded as you meet different people, and you're open in the sense of meeting people and, just especially when you go for 6 hours without seeing another human being, when you do see one that you kind of try to meet and have this sort of contact. I found myself at times just crying, you know, without a very clear cause, found myself laughing out loud, you know, alone, because there's also that. I mean, what you get when you have that sort of solitude. But overall, I would say if I had to describe my walk in one word, it would be fun. It was like play. You know, like when you see kids playing, it was like play. And so here is the thing where I'm the spoiled, you know, it's true. There was a night where things were really, it was rained. You know, I walked through the rain the whole day. I walked 20 miles. And I thought to myself, you know, I have two things that a medieval pilgrim would not have had. And that's a cell phone and a credit card. And that's when I called, you know, I called a hotel and I said, do you have a room for tonight? And they had a room and they had heat. And it was awesome because they also had a restaurant and it was my birthday. And so that was my birthday treat. So, I mean, it also, to me at least, it helps me to appreciate those things I do have. I think it's also a very, you know, I filled out a survey. Someone was doing some research on why people walk and there were questions. And they said, so what is your primary motive for walking the Via Francigena? And it was like religious, generally spiritual, to be closer to nature, for exercise, personal challenge. And I checked everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, oh, all of the above. And then, but at the same time, I didn't feel like any one of those things really captured it. Mm. You know, that I think you'll appreciate it when you start walking.
Well, I'm really excited to start.
Yeah. I do think, I mean, it ends up making you think about other modes of transit, like how we move, and you know, everything is like, oh, I have to do things faster, and yes, I'm going to go running, and I'm also going to listen to a podcast at the same time. You know, it's like, oh, then it's even better because now I'm doing two things at once. Oh, and I'm going to stop and send this text. Like, we're trying to do so many things, and sometimes doing just one thing, which is putting one foot in front of the other, which is the most basic thing. Kids start doing it when they're 12 months old. I think that really gets you back to what it means to be human. So.
Great. I'm really excited.
You should be excited.
I am.
I am a little bit jealous, but we decided that this was your.
This one I'm going to do on my own, and then we're going to do a bunch of different walks together. So there are other walks we're looking at. We're thinking about the Way of St. Francis, which is between through Umbria and Assisi to Rome. We're thinking of the Via Francigena del Sud. And we might actually do other parts of the other Francigena.
Yeah, we should mention.
And at some point, I definitely have on my list outside of our literary Italy, I would love to go to Israel and to the Holy Land.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think we've talked about some of the hikes that we did with kids in Umbria, also around the Amalfi Coast, around Naples. Maybe we didn't talk about that one. But Italy, I mean, it's crisscrossed all over with hikes, with wonderful hiking trails. And a lot of times I think tourists are thinking Rome, Florence, Venice, and they're very much fixated on the cities. And you get in the train and you pass through this gorgeous countryside and you think, how do I get there? Well, you might not be able to get there by train. And in some cases, like some of these towns I was in, you can't. You cannot get there by train. And maybe you can't even get there by bus. And some of the countryside, you couldn't get there by car. You know, I was in the middle of the woods in some places. And and for a small and very developed country, there's still quite a bit of nature in Italy. And I think that to be there firsthand, you appreciate that and you want to preserve it. That all of Italy isn't Rome, Florence.
So what would I buon peregrinaggio? What would I say?
Buon cammino.
Buon cammino.
So in Spain, they say buon cammino. But it's buon cammino. It's CAMMINO.
Well, thanks for wishing it.
And occasionally, you know, I would walk by just someone who was maybe doing work in their garden, and they would say, oh, buon
cammino. And we'll have to do another podcast like this when I'm back, and I can, you know, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know that we can figure out the logistics of.
I'm not going to do a podcast. That's kind of beside the point of doing the walk. We'd be recording a podcast during the walk.
No.
Don't want to do that.
So it's going to be great.
We'll have a few things queued up before I go. But we can, after I get back, we can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah. It's going to be great. I think you're going to love it.
All right.
Yeah.
Alla prossima.
Buon cammino.
Buon cammino.